This is Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zint in for Jane Lindholm. Today, Tropical Storm Irene 5 years on. We're going to talk to a number of people about the long-term effects of the storm on their lives and their communities, but we also want to hear from you. If you were in a town hit by Irene, what's changed? Are you better prepared for another Irene or still too vulnerable? Is that spirit of working together that was so prevalent right after the storm still evident? Maybe there's a fifth anniversary event you want to tell us about. Call us at 1-800-639-2211. You can email your comments to vermontedition@vpr.net or even post your comment on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. A number of Vermont communities also, especially near Lake Champlain, were affected by spring flooding the same year, 2011. And if you're in one of those towns, we'd welcome your call as well. We're going to begin with the Vermont Economic Resiliency Initiative, VERI for short, which was established in the wake of Tropical Storm Irene. It was a state effort that focused on 5 towns and made specific recommendations those towns could adopt to reduce flood risk, protect life and property, and help businesses stay open in the wake of a disaster. We talked this week with Chris Cochran, who's Vermont's Director of Community Planning and Revitalization, and we asked him what residents of those 5 communities might find has changed in their towns as a result of the initiative.
Well, it largely depends on the community and their capacity to execute. As you mentioned, we worked in 5 communities. We worked in Barrie, Brattleboro, Brandon, Enosburg, and Woodstock. And the larger communities, frankly, have more staff and more capacity to execute. So in Brattleboro and Brandon, for example, you'll see they've advanced a lot more than some of the other communities that are just smaller and that have smaller staffs. Barrie, kind of as we were wrapping up these reports and recommendations, suffered a flood last year. And that also added, I guess, some political pressure to act. And they are currently engaged in a process to buy out properties and create some floodplain in the downtown area to minimize future floods and threats to businesses. Brandon just received a $3.1 million hazard mitigation grant. They were hit bad in Irene. The whole downtown area was impacted, and they are linking a kind of a flood mitigation project to allow the Neshobee River to flow through the downtown through an overflow culvert and limit future flood risk to the downtown area.
We mentioned all those goals of the initiative about enabling businesses to stay open, protecting infrastructure, protecting property. Does it really then all come down to something like what you described, which is we're going to try to make sure that the rivers stay where we're not in their way?
That's a great point. I mean, frankly, Vermont grew up on rivers and water for reasons of commerce. And these are densely settled areas that we can't reasonably move them to another place. So what we have to look at is ways that we can mitigate future risks. We do know Vermont is getting wetter. So the important thing to do now is take steps to mitigate and reduce those threats into the future. What I initially talked about was a lot of projects, but there's also policies and training and education and preparation that communities can do, because you can't anticipate all risks, but to the extent that you take steps to become prepared today can help mitigate your risks in the future.
Well, let's talk about policies. What, for example, are we talking about? Zoning policies?
Yeah, land use regulations is one tool, but there's also opportunities. For example, when buildings are approved, there's opportunities to floodproof them, and there's various techniques where you can have the building designed to get wet, where after the flood you just quickly clean it out and then you're back open to business. Or you can essentially harden the building and try to keep all the floodwater out. So once the floodwaters drop, the business and community can bounce back quickly from the event and get on with business.
So have you seen buildings like that constructed in any of these communities?
Yeah, Brattleboro has a number of them.
But these are buildings that have gone up, Chris, since Irene?
No, some of them prior to and then some of them subsequent. A lot of these are retrofits to existing buildings. So there are ways of protecting these existing and historic buildings.
The report that came out of the initiative had a lot of recommendations for these communities, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And there was a range from kind of fairly easy things you can do, kind of tailored projects that were very achievable. And there were harder projects, like the ones I mentioned in Barrie and Brandon, where it takes money and time to make these things happen. But communities, you know, usually once they have a roadmap and a plan based on their capacities, do slowly tick these off over time.
You mentioned that resources are an issue. I don't think there was any financial help that came as part of the initiative. It was largely technical help, correct?
That's right. After we delivered the final recommendations to the communities, we offered to sit down with the communities with our agency partners, primarily VTrans, ANR, VHCB, Vermont Housing and Conservation Board, our philanthropic partners, and let them know that we were here to help. The other important funding source was the Department of Homeland Security. They administer the Hazard Mitigation Grant Program. And we let them know that we were here and willing to support these projects in any way we can. And for this and other reasons, I think this was a key factor in making sure that the projects came to fruition.
When you look at the recommendations for these communities that emerged from the initiative, how much do you think ultimately will be accomplished, and how much is just going to be perhaps not accomplished strictly because cost is an obstacle?
Communities are control, you know, their own destiny. We can offer support, we can give them guidance, we can give them a plan, but ultimately the decision to implement, where they allocate their resources, where they set their priorities is a local decision. We're very pleased, you know, by the results we've seen so far. You know, all of the communities that we worked with have taken steps in the right direction. But there's a way of kind of quantifying it and measuring it. It's not something the state can control, but it's certainly something we can support.
As we get further and further away from Irene, 5 years now, are you concerned that communities sort of lose sight of the importance of this because it becomes more and more of a distant memory?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's a very fair statement, and I think it's true across the nation and in Vermont. I think we saw in the years after Irene a certain fatigue about Irene and the recovery efforts. And I think communities, the desire for individuals, communities, and businesses is to get back to normal and put these things into the past. But it's dangerous, I think, to think like that, although it's human nature. It's important because we do know when another flood will come, and we do know because of Barrie and other studies that there are risks. That it's important that we really do take steps today to mitigate future risks.
You know, the initiative focused on five communities, and I think it drew those five from an initial list of 32. And of course, there were dozens and dozens of Vermont communities affected by Tropical Storm Irene. Are these five communities somehow better off than the others?
In some ways, yes, because they have a roadmap that they can use. But the five communities were selected for specific reasons to provide examples for similar communities. So for we chose a downtown, we chose a village, so a smaller context. We chose a farming community, and we chose communities that were largely supported by tourists and visitors. So while these communities do have a roadmap, their roadmap can be applied and used by communities with a similar profile.
It interests me because we've talked so much about resiliency, whether we have actually become more resilient. And I think what you're saying is, you know, in some cases we've made some changes. In other cases, you know, it's economically not feasible. But we've created a model and a roadmap that communities can look to if they want to consider how they can become more resilient.
I don't know if you recall, you know, in the immediate aftermath of Irene, we did those community listening sessions where we went all across the state, 13 communities, and we kind of wanted to hear from communities what we did right and what we did wrong. Yeah. And they gave us kind of some good marching orders, you know, about what needed to happen. And a goal of Barrie was to kind of address some of those concerns. There wasn't good data out there to let communities know where their risks were. And FEMA's flood maps weren't updated regularly and had limitations because of how they approached flooding. Their flooding is, you know, based on inundation, and that's not the type of flooding we see in Vermont. Some of our rules and policies at the state level were not looking forward to the next 50 years in a changing environment. So, you know, the state adopted new road and bridge standards to make sure that, you know, when improvements were made, that we can allow for increased flows. The state created a map layer to address river flooding, you know, so people can, you know if they're in a hazard area because due to the limitations on FEMA's maps. And the state's looking forward to the next 5 or 10 years and working on creating tools to make the transportation network more resilient.
Chris Cochran, Vermont Director of Community Planning and Revitalization, thanks very much.
Hey, it was my pleasure, Steve. Thanks, and have a great day.
You can find a link to the Vermont Economic Resiliency Initiative on the show page for Vermont Edition at vpr.net. Today we're talking about Tropical Storm Irene because the fifth anniversary is approaching, 2011 on August 28th. And it wasn't the only flooding that year. In the spring, there was record-breaking flooding, especially along Lake Champlain. The floods brought changes to the landscape of many communities, and as we mark the fifth anniversary, we're asking you, what else changed? Did it alter the way your town looks at development in flood-prone areas or plans for how it will respond to future storms? Are communities better and stronger, or are the losses from Irene still evident? I'd like to hear from you at 1-800-639-2211. You can post a comment on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's check in with Joe, who's calling from Bridport. Hi, Joe.
Hi. Interesting that you actually mentioned on your program the spring flood, because that seems to have been pretty much forgotten. I live right on the shore of Lake Champlain. Thought I would never get flooded, and boy, I got it really badly impacted from it. I have not recovered. I haven't even assessed what I've lost. I got $800 of FEMA money for a water heater. That was it, because the building that got hit the worst was uninhabited at the time. So, yeah.
When you say you've not recovered, Joe, what do you have left to make yourself whole?
Cleaning up the mess that I have in my in both buildings, really. Uh-huh. And I mean, I haven't even totally cleaned up my yard yet. It's just, you know, it impacted me so severely that it was 3 weeks of hell for me, and I had to really get busy just to get my head above water, which I still haven't done economically. And meanwhile, I've got two moldy dwellings, one of which I'm living in, and the other one is my workshop, which is a complete disaster. And, you know, I don't think people appreciate just how much this impacted some people along the lake. It was a record flood that I hope will never reoccur, but considering climate change, who knows?
Well, Joe, thanks for calling us and reminding us of that spring flooding along Lake Champlain, and best of luck in your ongoing efforts to clean up. Again, our number, 1-800-639-2211. Bridport was one town obviously affected by those spring floods. In Irene, there was a group of towns that were essentially turned into islands because all the roads leading into them were washed away. And one of those towns was Plymouth. Now the Plymouth Historical Society has created a movie called Irene, Ruin to Renewal, that they're showing for the first time tomorrow and Sunday at the Calvin Coolidge State Historic Site there. We've got a clip from the film. This is Lawrence Jeffrey, who owned the Echo Lake Inn in the Tyson area of Plymouth at the time of Irene, and he's describing that frightening sound that many people heard who were close to streams and rivers when the storm was taking place.
There was this thundering sound. Then I heard the screams of the people out front, and I came running out to the front to see this huge wall of water just pouring down the road. It was probably 2 to 3 feet high of brown, dark, and moving incredibly fast. And it was carrying boulders. I heard this thundering, almost like a Sherman tank was just rolling right by the end. And it was the stones, and these bigger stones, crashing onto the pavement. I'm getting goosebumps right now.
That's Lawrence Jeffrey describing the scene outside of Echo Lake Inn in Plymouth during Tropical Storm Irene. And that's part of the film we mentioned that the Plymouth Historical Society has put together called Irene, Ruin to Renewal. And joining us now is Betsy Tonkin, who's the president of the Historical Society and the project manager of the film. Betsy, thanks for taking the time today.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I have a very vivid memory of driving through Plymouth, and I recall it was about a month after Irene, and I felt stunned by what I saw. And one kind of image remains in my mind. It was along the highway there. There was a sign on a house. I can't remember the exact wording, but it said something about, "We need food." And it just kind of underscored the effect of the storm on Plymouth. Maybe you can tell us just, you know, in a larger way, how the entire town was affected by Irene.
Well, obviously, living in a rural town of Vermont where you're surrounded by mountains, where rivers are coming down, and then a valley floors where rivers travel along roadsides, the devastation was all-encompassing around town. And there were some iconic scenes, one of which you had mentioned. There was one also at the junction of Moneybrook and Route 100, where a portion of the mountain up above came down, and the river brought with it that mountainside with huge boulders, trees, all sorts of debris, and deposited it in the flat area along Route 100. It was a virtual field of boulders, and many people described it as a moonscape kind of scene. And it was really, really surreal. And many people drove through there, and their eyes were popping out of their heads. Then there was a house in Plymouth Union that was totally blown apart by water coming down from the mountain above. So there were scenes of this tremendous destruction all throughout town, and it was quite a shock for people coming through Plymouth, not only the Plymouth residents but visitors coming through.
How does the film then capture what Irene was like for Plymouth? Is this something you did recently, going around and talking to people?
Right. Well, the film got started as an effort to document the historic event. But as we were gathering material for the film and we were hearing stories, we realized that there was something much bigger than what just the photos and the videos could convey. And that something much bigger is what we wanted to capture in our video. So we started talking to people, and that's when the story started to reveal to us the nature of this true disaster.
People have a hard time talking about it in some cases?
Well, you know, as time goes by, people are less emotional, but it was interesting during our interview process. There were people that were close to tears, if not in tears, as they recalled some of the experiences that they had.
What do you hope the film will accomplish in terms of, you know, Plymouth residents who go see it this weekend?
Well, number one was obviously to document the historic event, but we also wanted to honor the people that took part in the recovery efforts. We also wanted to, I guess, highlight or showcase some of the amazing stories that took place in different parts of Plymouth, stories that most people were unaware of, events that our video committee dubbed "I Didn't Know That" stories. But it was also to remind us of how strong and how engaged we can be when we reach out to our neighbors, when we stay connected, when we have that sense of community. Our lives and our culture is healthier because of it. You know, and in a rural state like Vermont, we tend to live insular lives. We tend to stay in our own little piece of paradise. So we need a nudge every once in a while. And the video, every time the video is plugged into the computer or a DVD player, that should be our reminder of what we could be and what we should be.
Betsy Tonkin, thanks for talking with us today, and good luck with the film.
Thank you so much.
Irene, Ruin to Renewal will be shown this weekend at the Calvin Coolidge site as part, and it was done by the Plymouth Historical Society, which Betsy is part of. We're talking about the long-term effects and lessons of Tropical Storm Irene in towns like Plymouth that were hardest hit. The memories remain fresh. Many communities, not only Plymouth, are planning commemorations this weekend to mark the fifth anniversary. Is your town one of them? Let us know what's happening, what's changed or not changed in town since the storm. Our number, 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zinden for Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. As we mark the fifth anniversary of Tropical Storm Irene, recalling the effects of the storm, asking whether our communities are better off, wondering, too, what remains in your community of that spirit that prevailed so much during the difficult weeks and months after Irene. You can call us at 1-800-639-2211 or email us at vermontedition@vpr.net. We got this email comment from Ellen in Whiting, who writes, Tropical Storm Irene brought historic flooding devastation to towns all around us, washing away buildings, bridges, and cutting off roads and travel to the south and east of us. As the floodwaters from the Otter Creek began to lift the pavement off our town roads, we filled out paperwork from FEMA for help, like our neighboring towns. In December, we reckoned the town would be able to pay for the damage from our annual road budget. When we put it before the town at town meeting, the voters decided in a unanimous voice vote to send a donation to the Vermont Disaster Relief Fund, equal to the amount we eventually received from FEMA. This is the fund that helped folks who lost everything in the storm and had no means to recover. Ellen says, I'm so proud of my neighbors, equally proud to live in my town. And here's Jeremy, who's calling us today from Hubbardton. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
I'm glad. Thanks for taking my call. I'm glad to be able to speak up. I can speak to one of the effects after the storm of the roads being out and the difficulty in getting around. I happen to be an underground utility locator under the auspices of DigSafe. And basically, everywhere I had to be was everywhere you couldn't get to. My area at that time included Pittsfield, Bethel, up and down Route 100, including Plymouth. It was just amazing to see what had happened to the roads, particularly in Bridgewater. Basically, the town of Bridgewater moved to West Bridgewater. Houses were literally miles down the road from where they had been. The big green iron bridge near in Woodstock traveled almost a mile down the river. And getting to Bethel was basically impossible. We've seen the story. We know it was impossible to get in or near Pittsfield, Rochester. And unfortunately, some of these effects are still affecting us today. I am still to this day getting tickets from DigSafe for repairs and upgrades based largely on the damage that occurred all the way, back 5 years ago.
Now, DigSafe, remind us, Jeremy, you're looking at underground infrastructure, essentially?
Correct. Yes. Yeah. If any subsurface work needs to be done before teeth are put in the ground by an excavator, DigSafe needs to be contacted so that we can locate any underground telephone or power or cable TV that might be in the area to keep the operators on the equipment safe.
So you're basically still chasing damage from Irene.
Correct. One thing that concerns me somewhat is it seems almost like the subsurface underground is still affected because of the inundation of water that we had. Mm-hmm. To this day, I'm still getting calls. Anytime we get more than maybe an inch or two of rain in a fairly short period, like a matter of hours, bits of Richmond are still moving to other bits of Richmond. Road washouts still occur, and I think it's much more prevalent than it ever used to be. Yeah. Because of the sheer amount of water that we got during that storm.
Yeah, Jeremy, I think it is interesting how unstable maybe some, as you're suggesting, some of the underground layers, but also when you drive by streams and rivers that were affected by Irene, you look at those stream banks and it just looks like in many cases it wouldn't take much to disrupt them. So thanks for the call, Jeremy. Really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Let's talk to Scott Murphy, who's city manager of Wilmington, a community that was very hard hit by Irene. In their case, the entire business district was underwater as a result of the storm, which had a significant impact on the economy of Wilmington. Scott Murphy took over the city manager job shortly after the storm hit when the former city manager resigned, and he joins us now to talk about the rebuilding of Wilmington. Scott Murphy, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, hi, Steve. How you doing?
You came from Bennington. Paddington, if I'm correct, which also saw some pretty dramatic flooding. I wonder, you know, having seen Bennington, were you surprised by what you found in Wilmington, or was it pretty similar to what you saw in Bennington?
Wilmington was much more devastated. It was much more localized, and certainly people were aware of the damage in Wilmington because the word had gotten out that they needed a lot of help and that they were isolated.
One of the, I thought, unique aspects of Wilmington, I mean, you know, other towns were affected and businesses were affected, but the entire business district was really hard hit in Wilmington. So when you sort of looked at what needed to be done, and there you were a month or two after Irene had hit, what were the biggest projects that you had to accomplish?
We had 46 buildings out of our 57, which are located in the historic district, were flooded. So, you know, the main thing was getting them back up and running, and providing the infrastructure improvements that they needed to receive supplies and receive customers. Actually, we because initially people, the public, were not allowed back into Wilmington. So we focused on the infrastructure improvements. We had 63 project worksheets with FEMA. And as anybody knows who dealt with FEMA, those, some of them go easily, but most of them do not. And so it took quite a while. We just finished our last project worksheet about a year and a half ago.
Were there businesses that didn't make it after Irene?
Absolutely. And you know, there were some that were struggling at that point, and then when Irene hit, that just, you know, put them over the edge. But looking back now, 5 years later, we've come out a lot stronger. The businesses that are here that survived and managed to reopen are doing fairly well. Some are actually flourishing. We've got the travelers coming back through town. We've got new businesses, new restaurants, new buildings. And, you know, we've learned a lot from Irene. I think one of the best things we've gotten from Irene is emergency management preparedness. So we're ready for not another Irene, God no, but certainly we're ready for anything that might come our way, and hopefully we can handle something like that.
You know, we talk about making communities more resilient, but, you know, Wilmington's just an ideal example of what we talk about when we say Vermont towns are often located in valleys and along rivers. You've got a river running right through the middle of the business district. So how much more resilient can you actually be than before Irene hit?
Well, that's a good question. And part of FEMA's follow-up afterwards was, you know, what can we do to make you more resilient? And you know, there are minor things that we could do and have done. But, you know, one of the suggestions that came from the Army Corps of Engineers was to move the village.
Right.
And that just turned to be unrealistic.
Scott, thanks for talking with us today.
You're welcome.
Scott Murphy is the town manager in Wilmington. As we know, the impact of Irene went beyond damage to buildings and roads and bridges. The storm had an emotional and psychological effect as well. And hard rain can still stir feelings of anxiety for some of those who lost much in the storm. Chris Trebert has a South Newfane home that was damaged by the flooding. As an artist, she found another way to harness her feelings about the storm and come to terms with how it changed the world around her. And she joins us now. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
So your home is on your property, but also your photography studio, which had to be gutted after Irene. And from what I understand, it was a while before you could work as a result of that. And your work had been photographing fine art and doing photographs for catalogs. But when you got back to it, you felt differently about it, basically. What happened?
It's not so much that I felt differently about my work. It was that I found that I needed to do something with the experience here, and using my work to do that, to reflect what we actually went through here through Irene. It did take about 6 months or so to get back in the studio, and when we did, it was sort of a reassessment of, well, what do I want to do now that I'm back to work? You can't just jump back in where you were. And I had some projects that I had been working on that we had to let go of, and some things that we never picked back up again. What happened to me was I had, after the storm, after all the devastation on our property, in the cleanup, I started setting aside things that I found interesting, even among all the debris. As you look up, look at things closely, I started to see some beauty in some of the things of the destruction of the storm. And I wound up developing a still life project out of all of the, out of some of the stuff that I actually collected in the cleanup after Irene. And that was a still life project that took me the better part of, I'd say, 2 years to finish.
These are photographs that are part of the exhibition at the Folklife Center?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. It's on display now at the Folklife Center in Middlebury.
So basically, has all of this pointed you in a new direction for future work?
Well, somewhat. I mean, the way I work is something comes to me my fine art work. Something comes to me, something that I'm attracted to, and I spend some time working on it and complete it. This was a project that I had no idea that I would ever get involved in, but it's one that came to me as a, sort of a way of making order out of the chaos of the experience of Irene. And so as that project has, you know, it took a while for me to envision it and create it. And that project in itself is done, but since then I found that still life work really is something that I now feel passionate about.
Chris, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Chris's photographs are part of a two-part exhibition at the Vermont Folklife Center in Middlebury. It's called Geomorph: Things Change and They Change Again. We've got time to take a call from John in Waitsfield. Hi, John. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi. My comment is in regards to the post-recovery funding of town municipal projects. In Waitsfield, they built a town hall. That town hall's project price came in at $1.2 million. There are three people who work in that office. The town tried to protest it, and the folks tried to protest it. The town just kept on pushing, saying, oh, this is grant money. Grant money is my tax dollars. There was a building they could have utilized, purchased it for probably less than $400,000, and it would have worked perfectly for them and done the job. But the select board continued to push that this was something that was going to make the Irene recovery wonderful. And basically my comment is that there was a lot of grabbing of money and utilizing it because it was there. And I find that to be very distasteful.
John, thanks for the call. And I do recall reading about this debate in Waitsfield, and I think in other towns, too, there have been discussions about the best use of FEMA money, whether the whole process of going through applications for FEMA grants was well managed. It was certainly an overwhelming undertaking, especially for small towns like Waitsfield, but I appreciate you bringing that up. And I appreciate the other comments from callers and guests today as we mark the fifth anniversary of Tropical Storm Irene. In a moment, we'll talk with Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders about campaigning for Hillary Clinton, his new political organization, and his upcoming book. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zind. This week, after months of being essentially unavailable to the Vermont press while he was running his campaign to win the Democratic presidential nomination, Senator Bernie Sanders launched something of a media blitz. His office offered news organizations short interviews with the senator, and we spoke with him on Wednesday. I started by asking Senator Sanders about reports of the resignations of several staff members from his new political organization, Our Revolution.
Let me just say a few things about it. I am not actively involved in the organization. This organization comes from the campaign, and the goal of it was to continue the kind of energy that the campaign brought forth, getting people involved in the political process, taking on big money, etc. I believe, I won't swear to you, that we had about 15 people. I think five people left. I think you have personality differences. But the organization is now headed by a fellow named Larry Cohen, who was a longtime head. He's going to be chairman of the board of the Communication Workers of America. Larry is going to do a great job putting together a very, very a good board of progressive leaders from all across the country. And I think that's is an organization that is going to do some very good things.
Let me just ask you one thing about the group, and that's about its 501c4 status, which I understand means it doesn't have to reveal information about donors. And doesn't this just add to the problem of dark money in politics that you...
Well, for a start, right now no decisions have been made about how money is going to come in. The problem, and Mike, as you know, in our campaign, what we were very, very proud of is that we broke all kinds of records in terms of the number of small individual campaign contributions that we received. And that is the way I believe we should do it. But that will be a decision for the board. I think we must remain dependent upon small campaign contributions.
Should the group disclose its donors?
Yeah, I think so. Absolutely.
All right. You've said that you'll be campaigning, I think, after Labor Day for Secretary Clinton. We did a recent poll at VPR which showed a pretty significant percentage of those people who backed you don't plan on supporting Secretary Clinton. So other than, and you've said this many times, that you think a Trump presidency would be disastrous, other than that argument, what's the positive argument you make to those folks to vote for Secretary
Clinton? Well, first of all, I'm not familiar with your poll, but nationally, I think the overwhelming majority of people who voted for me will be voting for Secretary Clinton, certainly not all. But I think the vast majority will. And I think the answer is pretty clear. In my view, Donald Trump would be a disaster for this country if he were to be elected president. I think, in fact, Steve, and I say this in all honesty, he is the worst candidate of any major political party that I have seen in my adult life. And I think he would be an international embarrassment for our country. So I'm going to do everything I can to see that Trump is not elected president. Hillary Clinton, it is no great secret, and I have our differences of opinion. I did run against her for president, and we have real differences. On the other hand, on many important issues, I think Clinton's position is strong. For example, I regard campaign finance reform, the idea that the Koch brothers right now are literally trying to buy the United States Senate, spending hundreds of millions of dollars. I think this is absolutely disgraceful, and it's undermining American democracy. Secretary Clinton has been very clear that she will not appoint or nominate people to the United States Supreme Court unless they are prepared to overturn Citizens United. And I think that's enormously important, not to mention protecting a woman's right to choose and decisions regarding environmental issues and labor issues and so forth and so on. Second of all, Secretary Clinton and I worked toward the end of the campaign on two very important proposals. She came on board the idea that public colleges and universities should be tuition-free. Now, think what that means for the young people here in Vermont and around this country. Tuition-free public colleges and universities, her view is it should be for 120 people in families making $125,000 a year or less. That's 83% of the population. That's a pretty big deal. That's her view. Secretary Clinton also agreed with me on our proposal to double funding for community health centers around this country. Here in Vermont, almost 25% of the people get their primary health care, dental care, et cetera, in the community health centers. We can double funding for that under Clinton. That's a pretty big deal as well. So I have differences with Clinton. I know that many of my supporters have differences with Clinton, but I think there is not the shadow of a doubt that she is far, far, far superior on virtually every issue than Donald Trump is.
You know, during the debates, you kind of famously dismissed her email troubles as a distraction from the substantive issues. But I think since then there have been developments. The FBI rebuked her. There's, this week reports of additional emails being found. Anything that's happened since those debates troubles you more about the emails than
it's not a question of troubling me. I think what we have got to do is to focus less on the personality of Donald Trump and his bankruptcies and everything else. It's interesting. Media likes it. Or Hillary Clinton's problems. And I'm not saying that these may or may not be serious. But what we have got to focus on are the issues facing the American people. And that's what I meant when I said that. Right now you got a middle class which is in decline. We have massive levels of income and wealth inequality. We're the only country, major country, that doesn't guarantee health care to all people. We got a minimum wage, which is nationally a starvation wage. Climate change is threatening the very existence of this planet. Those are the issues, I believe. I'm not saying these other issues are not consequential, but I am saying that those issues that affect the American people, and in fact the world, are the issues that we have to focus on. And if you look at those issues, issue by issue, Donald Trump does not believe in what scientists were saying regarding climate change. He believes it's a hoax. Clinton takes it very seriously. So I think, you know, that you've got to, as a nation, we have got to focus on the real issues impacting the American people. And I think when we do that, you find that on every issue, Clinton is far superior.
You said this week that now that you're no longer a candidate, releasing information about your personal finances as required by the FEC would be a waste of time. But
no, that's not exactly what I said.
Well, that's what the quote in the Free Press said.
Maybe that not always right. What I said is that I did release a personal financial disclosure form as a presidential candidate, totally appropriate. By the time the next form came around, I was not going to become president of the United States. And it takes a little bit of time and a little bit of energy, and I'm running around the country. And that same information is in my Senate personal financial disclosure form. So given the fact that I was not going to become president, the campaign had been lost by then, we didn't think it was necessary to do.
So filing for the extensions wasn't running the clock out on that?
No. It was no longer necessary to file. And by the way, I mean, what people will see in my disclosure forms, what they would have seen, is not a hell of a lot of difference in our financial situation over that period of time.
You have a new book. I don't know where you are with it, Our Revolution.
Well, I wish I could tell you I had a new book. I am working on it.
We'll have?
Yes.
What do you think we'll learn from it?
Well, two things. Perhaps the most important part of what it will be is simply, I don't know what we're going to call the section, but it'll be a 40% of the book, is an agenda for a new America. Where do we go from here? How do we transform a nation which has massive levels of income and wealth inequality, a declining middle class, too much poverty, not enough people have health care, climate change threat, trade disasters? It's going to be a fairly detailed program of, you know, in a sense, I guess, what I would have done if I were elected president of the United States, the agenda that I would have brought forth. And I think it's important that we get those ideas out there. And obviously, I hope the book is widely read so people have a sense of where at least I think we should be going as a nation. The other half of the book, or maybe 60% of the book, you know, we'll be talking about the campaign, what I learned about the campaign. I visited, if my memory is correct, some 46 states in the country. And I saw a lot, and I met with extraordinary people and just had experiences that in a million years I otherwise would not have had. And, you know, we're going to talk about visiting Pine Ridge Native American Reservation, going to the Bronx and going to low-income high-rise apartments and learning about life there, talking about Latinos who are worried that, you know, family members are going to be deported. Talking about to workers whose jobs are now going to Mexico or to China. I learned an enormous amount, and I met an enormous number of fantastic people. And we'll be talking about that in the book.
You said that the campaign changed the discussion about the TPP trade agreement. It changed the national discussion about a $15 minimum wage and other issues. And maybe you just alluded to this in your answer, but in what ways did it change you?
Oh, profoundly. You know, it was an experience, you know, just an extraordinary experience for me and for Jane, for our family. You know, before I ran for president, I would come home, and I will continue to do that every weekend to Vermont. I love the state, and I love having town meetings and getting around the state. That's what I did. But for a year and a half, I traveled this country. And, you know, I'm thinking now in my mind, the young people that I met, the seniors that I met, the veterans that I met, you know, just an extraordinarily expansion of kind of the folks that I, you know, had previously been in contact with. And what I learned, and I say this, you know, not rhetorically, but very honestly, is there are beautiful, beautiful people out there. And they're black, and they're white, and they're Latino, and Asian American, and Native American. And people want real change, and people want to come together. People are not happy with a system in which almost all new income and wealth is going to the top 1%. and where we lag behind many other countries on the needs of working people. So that's kind of what I learned.
Senator Bernie Sanders, thanks for talking with us today.
Well, thank you very much, Steve. Take care. Bye-bye.
That's our program for today. Sugar has never been known for its robust nutritional value, but a new statement by the American Heart Association raises some serious concerns about the long-lasting effects that added sugars have on children. Dr. Rachel Johnson, a professor of nutrition at UVM, shares the findings with us Monday on Vermont Edition, and we welcome your questions or comments about the risks of added sugar for children at vermontedition@vpr.net, the email address, and then listen Monday at noon. Our program is produced by Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Liam Connors directed our show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Steve Zind. Hope you have a great weekend, and thanks for listening.